and I was knotted out on fentanyl, and I had a bag of meth setting out, and she put Flocka in the meth that I was doing.
Why?
Because of the $200 that
I was like, a fuck you?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, she had a resentment. I stuck the needle in my arm, and I pulled it back. The blood went in it. I looked up as I was pushing it down. She was like, I hate you. I did it and blacked out for 3 days. Didn't know who I was. Didn't know where I was. Didn't know how to eat. Couldn't get high, so I was withdrawing. Just complete psychosis. And it was so strong that I would go to sleep, and I would wake up still in psychosis. Like, at 23 years old. Slept in between my parents for 3 days because I was so scared.
Welcome to the Hell Has an Exit podcast with host Teddy Tarantino. New episodes every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to subscribe.
Hey, welcome to Hell Has an Exit. I'm your host, Brian Alzate. If you guys are a fan of the podcast, please like and subscribe on YouTube. If you guys want to follow us on Instagram, it's at Hell Has an Exit. We're most vocal on Instagram. We are on TikTok. If you're struggling or have any friends who are struggling, please send them the podcast. And just want to thank you guys for listening. Comment on the videos. It helps the engagement and the algorithm. And today we have Hunter Shepherd. What's up, man?
What's up? I'm happy to be here.
I was telling you earlier, I think you have the most viral before and after that I've ever seen.
Yeah, you know what's crazy? It actually originally went viral because I used to make like memes mm-hmm. out of myself whenever I was like a few months sober, and it would be like bad ones too. Like, I'd post some crazy stuff with it. Mm-hmm. And it just used to go so viral. I think that's really where it started at.
So you would get like a couple months clean and kind of like laugh at yourself?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I was 2 weeks sober and started to document my journey on mm-hmm. on social media. And a lot of it was humor.
Like, I showed that picture to my friend and she was like, why does his face get like that? And I was like, well, when I was on opiates, I would just pick at my face and you don't feel anything. But I don't know if that's what it was.
Yeah, it was meth mostly for me that did that. And I was in psychosis, so I did it like excessively, like literally my whole body was covered in it. It wasn't just like my face, mm-hmm. it was like my back, like in spots, like I don't even know how I reached.
I was wondering, when I saw the back, I was like, but that don't make no sense, because how would he pick his back?
Dude, I was so high.
I didn't know if it was like an infection or something. It was from picking?
Well, I think that's part of it, because, you know, whenever you're in it, you don't really take care of yourself.
Of course.
You know? So yeah, I mean, I wasn't living very clean, and I had MRSA, which is a common like staph infection mm-hmm. within drug addicts. So I had that before. And I think anytime that you like relapse and you get like that again, then it just kind of is worse, you know?
I mean, I kind of know, but I want people to know like what was going through your head. So like, what makes someone pick at their skin when they're on meth?
You know, I've always been a compulsive like picker, like picking at like, mm-hmm. you know, like pimples and stuff like that. And when you're on meth, it elevates stuff, you know, like weird compulsions that you might have. Mm-hmm. Like growing up, I used to pick at myself. Yeah, I think it's just it elevates your compulsion. So mm-hmm. I would think I was popping pimples, but they wouldn't even be pimples. I'd just be picking at my skin.
Yeah, I know when I was on opiates, I had like an itch and I'd just be like scratching my leg, and it'd be at night and I'd just be scratching and scratching. I'm like, why is it wet? And then I'd wake up in the morning, like my whole leg will be bloody up. And I would just be, because you can't feel it on opiates. That's like another thing, is you can't really feel your sense of pain. It's like what stops you from picking, because you're like, oh, that hurts.
Yeah.
But on drugs, you don't really have anything that stops you from doing that.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, I did that a lot on fentanyl as well.
Yeah.
Because it makes you so itchy.
I know.
Oh, it's awful.
Where are you from?
I'm from a place called the Mid-Ohio Valley, which is where Ohio and West Virginia border each other. And, I mean, it's the highest opiate overdose place in the United States. West Virginia is.
Now or back then?
Just in general.
Wow.
Yeah, it has been for years.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it's partially because the population isn't super high in West Virginia. I think there's only like 1 million some people in the whole state.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we were just plagued by OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, once that stuff was gone, then heroin and then eventually fentanyl pretty much killed like the whole state.
Wow. What was growing up like for you?
Yeah, so I grew up in a small town in Ohio, right, like 15 minutes from West Virginia. And yeah, I mean, I have a great family. You know, I'm the only one that suffers from addiction the way that I do. And yeah, I grew up in a small town where you could play out in the streets with your friends, and you know, I used to ride go-karts around, and life was good. My parents took me on vacation a lot when I was younger. I got to see a lot more than most people that grew up where I'm from. And yeah, whenever I was 12 years old, I was overweight. I had crooked teeth. I had this like weird slick back haircut. I didn't like who I was at all. And I also got diagnosed with ADD without hyperactivity, and they prescribed me with Adderall. And the reason that I mentioned the without hyperactivity is because Adderall helped me pay attention, but it worked still in a similar way to meth, you know, like I could abuse it. I learned from an early age that I could overtake Adderall and get high from it. So I was, you know, taking 6-7 Adderall at 12 years old.
Yeah. So the way it's supposed to work is that Adderall is supposed to calm people down that are ADHD, right?
Yeah.
And when you took it, you would still get hyper?
Yeah, yeah, I would still, yeah, I still would get hyper. If I took it normally, I could focus in school, but it gave me energy. Mm-hmm. And I lost that weight like quick, you know? So I lost weight on it. And yeah, I was a very unhappy, angry young man. And they prescribed me Adderall, which made that worse. And then I started to smoke weed and drink at 12 years old. Mm-hmm. So a mixture of the Adderall, weed, and alcohol.
Now, what was your family life like? Was your parents like okay with it? Were they not okay with it? Were you hiding it? Were your brothers, do you have brothers and sisters that were doing the same thing? Older friends?
Yeah, I've got three sisters. Two of them that I grew up with. And they smoked weed and drank and all of that, you know. So I kind of was desensitized to it. And that's kind of why I was curious to use it. I don't want to blame it on them, but, yeah, my dad has owned bars, my whole life. So he's seen addiction, you know, and he realized that I was going down that path. And he would try to discipline me, but his way of disciplining me was being angry and aggressive. And my mom was the major enabler, the exact opposite. And we would just clash, you know, we would butt heads, and we would actually get, I would be the aggressor, but we would get in fist fights, like literally as young as 12 years old. So I got arrested for the first time at 12 years old as well.
For what?
For me and my dad fighting. Yeah.
Did they side with him at the time?
Yeah, because...
That's so funny. I like figuring.
My dad knew all the police where I'm from. So as soon as they show up, you know, they automatically... I mean, given they're going to side with him anyway because he's the parent. But yeah, that made it worse for sure.
In hindsight, do you think that it was like fucked up of him? Or are you kind of like, man, I was so off the chain, I could see how he did that? Or a little bit of both?
Yeah, I don't think that his approach was right, you know, but I can understand his want to get me on the right path, you know. And for a long time I was angry and resentful, because over the period of my childhood I was on and off of probation and then eventually juvenile parole based off of this dynamic. So
yeah, so it kind of kept following you around.
Yeah.
What was high school like?
I hated it. I couldn't pay attention. I didn't learn like normal people. You know, I had a real struggle with structure. And, you know, I grew up in a place where it was a very small school. Everybody knows everybody. I was the kid that got arrested at 12 years old, the kid that was smoking weed and drinking. So yeah, it wasn't great. I definitely wasn't one of the popular kids. Yeah, it wasn't good. I got expelled a bunch, got in trouble a bunch.
When did, like drug addiction start to take its toll on you?
I would say straight away. I was obsessed with weed from the first time that I smoked it. You know, like literally from the very beginning, I didn't care what the consequences were. I didn't care about anything other than that.
You think you're a born an addict? Like born with that, like, disease?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. Because even long before I took Adderall, weed, alcohol, all of that, you know, I was overweight because of sugar and food. Mm-hmm. You know, I would binge eat and, you know.
Yeah, me too.
West Virginia is also one of the most obese states.
Wow. Damn, you guys got the most obesity and most overdose?
Well, it's one of the poorest, mm-hmm. one of the most drug addicted, one of the most, actually, it is the most obese. I mean, it's all kinds of things.
Yeah, I just know the Wonderful Whites.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the best documentary ever. Yeah. Yeah, I just remember being a kid and like, yo, West Virginia is off the chain.
Wild.
It's like that.
Yeah. You know, in that, whenever she's shaking the pill bottle, she goes, this is a West Virginia mating call.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just remember as a kid just being like, that is so crazy. And then, you know, I'm from Broward County and it was off the chain with pills here. But
yeah,
when I think of that, I just think of like family members shooting each other in the front yard and whatever. When did you start to think like, man, I think I have a problem?
Oh, it wasn't until way, way later. You know, I would say 21 years old is when I really was like, because I got sober at 23, mm-hmm. but 21 years old is when things like real shit started to hit the fan.
What led up to that point? Like, how has your life, like from high school to 21?
Yeah. So when I was 14, my childhood best friend died in a drunk driving accident. And it traumatized me. Like, I literally had to go to the hospital and see him, like, dying, you know? And that's, like, bad for a 14-year-old to witness, right? And that pushed me into, like, deep depression and, you know, drinking and overusing weed, like, smoking weed. And, yeah, so I kept getting in trouble. And I ended up in a program for 11 months that was for – you had to have a felony to go there. After I got out after 11 months, they gave me a chance to go back to the school that I had been expelled from. Started smoking weed straight away, even though I knew I was on my last chance before juvenile prison. Mm-hmm. Started smoking weed straight away, got into like an argument at school and they suspended me again. And I knew my probation officer was done with me. Right. So I went on the run. I stole everything I could from my house, went on the run with these guys that were like 19, 20 years old, and they were using heroin. So I'm 16 years old, and I used heroin for the first time.
Snorted?
No, injected it. Wow. First time, yeah.
Banging heroin at 16.
And it made me like really, really sick as well. It wasn't an enjoyable experience. Yeah. It was brutal. And it was not a good experience. And somebody told my probation officer where I was, mm-hmm. and the next day the police raid where I was looking for me. So they got me and they took me, they put me in juvenile prison, which in Ohio is called the Ohio Department of Youth Services, which is bad. I mean, probably 150 people there. I was like one of the 10 white dudes in this whole facility. So, you know, you stand out, you don't get it easy at that point. Like,
80. And I've heard like any youth camp is just so off the chain because those kids just like,
they don't care.
Yeah, they don't care.
They're wild. And in the state of Ohio, you can be in there until you're 21.
Oh, wow.
So you're in there with like 20-year-olds men that have been in there since they were 12 because they killed their mom or whatever. Like, you know, bad stuff. And there'd be like 80 people riots, like not even exaggerating, like 60, 70, 80 people riots.
What?
Yeah.
What would the riots be about?
Like, well, it was really based on the city where you're from. You get in these gangs. Now, I'm from a small area, so the where I'm from wasn't really associated with the gangs. But there would be like Columbus, Ohio and Cincinnati, Ohio versus Cleveland and Youngstown or whatever. Like, and they really just did it.
Just because they thought that was what you're supposed to do in jail?
To do it, you know? And also, there was also like drug trade in there and, you know, commissary trade and stuff like that. And they were kind of like, they would like beef over that, you know? But actually I took it as an opportunity in there, to get my GED. It was the first time that I had any kind of real structure, and I took advantage of it. But then as soon as I'm released, I'm put on juvenile parole. And at that time, Spice was big.
Yeah.
Like, it was real big, and you could pass a drug test using it.
Mm-hmm.
So straight away I got addicted to it, and it was like super addictive as well. Like the withdrawals from it.
People think it's like weed, but it's totally not.
Nothing like weed. Like, I would nod out on it like heroin, and then I would wake up hallucinating.
Hmm.
Like, it wasn't even an enjoyable high, but it was the only thing I could get away with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I met somebody, he's still my best friend to this day. And his uncle produced Spice in the UK and had it shipped to America, because at the time that was legal. And he would get it for like 50 cents a gram and sell it to me for like $3 a gram. And I would sell it for $20 a gram. So we just had like the grocery bags full of this stuff, Spice. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it would be.
What does it look like?
Like potpourri.
What's that? Like?
Like herbs.
Like oregano?
Not really. It was like, you know, like the stuff that they put in a bathroom and they scent it with mm-hmm. stuff? It was like that. And it was put in these 1 gram and 3 gram bags, and it was labeled warning. Like, it literally said mm-hmm. warning on the package. And
yeah, I remember it, like at the gas station, it like clearly be like not for human consumption.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so bad. And because we were getting so much of it, I literally just would smoke it all day long. Like, any money I made off of it, I was just smoking it.
You ever had like crazy bad trips? Because I know.
Oh, awful. It was all like real hallucinations, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a bad drug. And yeah, I got away with smoking it though for like probably like a year and a half. And I met my daughter's mom through this drug. We were using it together, and she got pregnant, and thank God she stopped smoking it and stopped using it, but I continued to use it. And then I remember one day out of nowhere, it just like my friend showed up and was like, hey, look, you know, they made it pretty much impossible to import it into the US. It's done. It's gone. And he literally gave me like the last gram bag that we had of it, and I smoked it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm withdrawing, right? And now I don't care about parole or whatever. And I start smoking straight away, Roxy 30s, which then led to fentanyl and heroin and whatever. Mm-hmm. And went on the run from my parole officer.
How old were you?
I was like, it's such a blur, but I was about 19.
Mm-hmm. And then what is the next couple years like, when, because like that's not even until you're 21 yet.
Yeah. So my parole officer caught up with me. He put me back in juvenile prison. So my daughter is like literally like a little baby, like a couple months old, visiting me.
Mm.
I also share about this as well. Like, when my daughter was born, it was like one of the most beautiful moments of my life, you know? Like, she was born, and the doctor's holding her, and I started talking, and she literally looked at me and smiled. She didn't cry or anything. They were worried because she wasn't making any noise.
Mm-hmm.
And I started talking, and she recognized my voice, and she looked at me and smiled. And in a normal person's mind, they're like, oh, that should be enough for you to be sober.
Mm-hmm.
But it was literally, addiction had such a grab on me that an hour later I'm in the parking lot using, because I couldn't get past the withdrawals, you know? So I'm like literally in the parking lot using. And a couple months later, they caught me, put me in juvenile prison. Then my daughter's visiting me. And I think I got like 3 months sober. It was just a probation or a parole violation. And they let me out. And for the first time since I was 12 years old, they let me out off of parole. It was the first time in years that I had been free from, you know, being under some kind of supervision. Mm-hmm. Straight away, I start smoking weed. Within a week, I'm smoking fentanyl and heroin and whatever. Yeah, and it was just straight misery for the next few years. I mean,
what were you doing to supply your high?
Just hustling any way I could, stealing, doing other things, but I could probably still get in trouble for it, so I'm not gonna go
yeah.
too far into it. But yeah, bad stuff, you know, stealing from anybody that I could. I had these like schemes that I would do. I would go, you know, drugs.com. It's where you can like look up pill imprints. So I would go on there. I would go to CVS and I would steal these pills that were similar to 30s, like in a similar size. I would go on drugs.com and I would remove the real pill picture, put a picture of the fake pill, and then erase where it said the imprint and put the imprint of the fake pill. And I would go to people and I would sell them like a whole, like 300 of them, you know what I mean? Or 100 of them.
And then go online and be like,
no, not online. I would print them. I would print off the paper.
I'll get out of here.
So I would hand it to them and I would be like, hey, look, the people said they couldn't give you the bottle because X, Y, and Z, you know, whatever, they need to give it to their doctor. And, but they gave me this paper that the pharmacy gave them. I would hand them the paper, hand them the bag. They would look at the pills, look at the paper and be like, oh, okay. And hand me the money. I would do thousands of dollars.
Wow.
And for an addict, that goes a long ways, you know?
I used to do that with Simply Sleeps because they were like blue and little and they were just like over the counter, like fucking sleeping pills. And then I would put them in like, I'd buy miniature manila envelopes. So you can't see it through the bag. You could just look down it. And then I would do like 5, 7, 8 pills. And I like people, you can't really see it because it's not a clear bag.
Yeah.
And they would look down at it and be like, whatever. And then I did that for a while. But then, and then I do it with Claritin because they look like the white Roxy's. But
yeah, the same size.
Yeah. It's a difficult, you can't do that for too long. Anyone catch up with you?
Oh, no, not in a way where they would like try to do anything, but people did eventually like, you know, stop trusting me, you know, because I'm from a small, like the biggest city where I'm from is like 50,000 people, you know? Yeah, but I did have some hustle though. Like I would like, you know, sell stuff just to be able to like maintain. And during this period of time, I got really into like LSD, ecstasy. You know, I would mix all this stuff. I'd literally like smoke heroin and take ecstasy and acid and all of that together.
Wow.
That's what's wrong with me now, you know?
Yeah. You ever have flashbacks?
No. You know what? It's funny. I Googled that the other day. I'm like, if I go to the chiropractor.
You get your back pain, you have a flashback.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a myth. I don't know. They say like acid gets thrown in your back. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
I think I see stuff sometimes. Like I don't have like real visuals, but sometimes I'll see a traffic light brighter than like it should be.
Yeah.
And it just like gives me this feeling of tripping. And then sometimes I think like I see trails like still, like it'll happen randomly. And I don't know if I'm just making it up in my mind that this is from the acid, but yeah. I did acid for like 30 days straight and had like a crazy trip when I was like really young.
Yeah.
But
if I go to the chiropractor, is it considered a free lapse if I start tripping?
Maybe if you like it, if you start going back twice a day, it might be. Do you ever have any crazy acid trips?
Oh, dude, some bad ones, really bad ones. So, the last time that I used it, I had got this white acid, like, you know, white paper acid from this girl. And normally it would have lines on it. Like the people that make it would serrate it.
It's perforated, yeah.
This wasn't. It was just a sheet. White piece of paper. And I had taken it like 30 times at this point, right? So I'm like, oh, I can like estimate how much it is. I had to have taken like 5 hits at least. And I thought it was like maybe 2 or 3. Dude, and we took it and I underestimated how strong it was going to be as well. And we smoked meth until it kicked in. And dude, it was so scary. We went to these, there was like this old like bar that had shut down. This guy's dad owned it. And when he passed away, he gave it to him. So we went in this bar and it's just like a bunch of drug addicts and they're like hanging out, like getting high. It was like a trap house, right?
It's not a functional bar.
No, it was just shut down. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's like a bunch of us in there getting high. And this girl, I swear, she was like 300 pounds and she started overdosing and our high was starting to peak from this, right? And she was big too. And she like literally started overdosing and she was on her back. And you know, the death gurgle, if somebody's overdosing you know, she's like making this noise and we're peeking. And it was like the scariest shit that I've ever seen. Like, I couldn't even tell you what happened from that moment on. It was awful. It wasn't enjoyable.
Did she die?
No, she didn't die. Okay. They called the ambulance. We left.
Okay.
They were like, oh, we're calling the ambulance. We're like,
we're getting out of here.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's crazy. Yeah, I've had my last trip was like really bad. But so then what leads up to 21 for you to start thinking like, damn, like you don't even think you have a problem with this whole time?
No, because what happened was at 21, on my 21st birthday, I did meth for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it brought me to my knees straight away. It took my,
more than the opiates.
Way more. Because it wasn't just about the drug. I mean, it was like the most mentally obsessed that I've ever been for a drug. So I chased it more than the other ones. But what really made that drug different is it brought me around people that were involved in bad stuff, you know? So I was constantly putting myself in bad situations that honestly, I probably could have died. You know, there was tons of situations that people could have killed me and wouldn't have thought twice about it. And the paranoia is just, you know, I would say overwhelming, but that's not even the right word for it. I mean, it's, I would have serious psychosis.
What's the most you've been awake?
Maybe like 10 days straight.
10 days?
Yeah, 10 days. And be like full-blown hallucinating.
When do you start hallucinating, like day four?
Oh, by like, nah, like day three, stuff starts to get weird.
Oh,
day three, things are getting weird.
Can you explain it to people? Because like, I'm a crackhead. I like smoking crack. So it's like, to me, crack, yeah, I've had psychosis where I thought things were happening to me. But we're talking about, I've only been up for maybe 2 days max.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not like up for a week at the time. So my hallucination is mainly drug-induced. And like lack of like eating a little bit, but your shit is like legit.
Yeah.
Physical, because it's also the drug, but like people who are lost at sea, they start to hallucinate. You know what I mean? So it's like your hallucination is a whole nother level.
Yeah. I mean, like legit, I remember this one time I went with these guys and we went out to this, like, it was like a cabin kind of in the country that his family had owned. And we're out there just like tweaking, right? And I'd been up for like probably like 4 or 5 days. And this was out like a dirt road. Like it was hard to get there. He had a truck. We were like driving out this dirt road. And I remember the paranoia kicked in and it was so bad that for like 10 hours straight, I couldn't stop peeking out the windows because I thought the police were coming up the driveway, but there was no way that nobody knew we were there. And for legit like 10 hours straight, like driving those dudes crazy because they were like,
no one's up
there. You know, I was probably freaking them out too a bit actually. But yeah, like I legit thought I could see police lights, thought I could see them coming up the driveway. I thought they were after us. Really, we're just like three tweakers, like, you know, with like a couple grams of meth. No police care about that. They're not coming after that, you know? But I was convinced.
Yeah. I remember every time I'd smoke crack, I'd be like, dude, nobody's coming. It's like, just don't. And as soon as I would take the first hit, I'd be looking at the rear view. Someone's following us. Yeah. I had this one friend who was, he never got paranoid. And I was like, how do you do that? And he was just like, I just don't. And I was just like, what? He's like, one day I just had it. And I just said, if they're going to get me, they're going to get me. And then I would be peeking out the window and he would open the front door and be like, there's nobody here. And I'd be like, close it. I'd be so scared. He would be screaming, we're smoking crack in here. Come get us. And I'm like, my heart would be pounding. I'm like, no, they're outside. He's like, there's no one outside. He would walk outside half naked with like a crack pipe and be like, there's no one here. And
did it help though eventually?
No. I stopped using with him. I couldn't, dude, because he would like make fun of my paranoia. He'd be like, there's nobody here.
Yeah.
I'd be like peeking through the blinds. He'd open them all the way. He'd be screaming, come get us. I just never got over it. I stopped hanging out with him.
You know, one time I was in the, like, literally the worst hotel where I'm from. It's like costs like $20 a night. It's bad, right? And an Indian family owns it. So there's like a whole, it's like a family of 10, right? And they live in the back of the hotel. Like there's the lobby and then there's stairs that go up and there's like an apartment and they live in there. And I never realized that, like, in active addiction. And I got a hotel room this one time right under where they live at. And I was so paranoid. There was like a glass, like a little like glass in the room. And I would put it up to my ear and I would have it up against the wall. And I was convinced that it was like the FBI or whatever, the sheriff's office on the other side, like on walkie talkies and stuff. Like, dude, that feeling, I think I'll never forget that feeling because it's so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's awful.
And you're so heightened. I literally would feel like I'm at war, and I remember being like under my covers, and I swore like bullets were flying over.
Yeah.
And then if I popped my head, I would die. And like, I'm literally under the covers as if I'm in a bunker and like bullets are flying. My heart's pounding. And then like, dude, a dog would bark down the street and I would just fucking want to throw up. Like,
And where did you, like, around here, where were you using it?
5 minutes away in like a house. You're like, my parents have a really nice house. Like, yeah. It'd be like a Wednesday morning, you know. I'd have school in like 2 hours. I'd be losing my mind. But yeah, I got clean at 17. So this was all like 14 to 17.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, the paranoia is like, you can't even explain to people. I mean, and meth is probably 100 times worse.
Oh, it's strong.
Which is crazy. It's wild. And you're mainly smoking it or shooting it?
When I first started, I was smoking it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was smoking it. But then I got with this girl that was like way older than me. And she had been using for like 10 years, like IV. And we would fight all the time, like, oh, you're wasting it because you're smoking it, this and that. And then she convinced me one time to do it. It was game over. But between 21 and 23, I don't come from like a wealthy family, right? But my mom has been an MRI tech for 30 years. So she had health insurance that gave me the ability to go to treatment. Which if it wasn't for that, like, I would have been in a bad way. So I, at 21 years old, you know, shit hit the fan quick with the meth, and I asked for help. And then over the next like 2 years, I was stuck in this cycle of hitting rock bottom, going to rehab for like 30 to 60 days, getting sober, getting confident, not working a program, not getting involved with any kind of recovery community or anything. And, you know, going home back to West Virginia. And
where would you go to treatment?
I came to treatment here
in Florida
the first two times. So I went to treatment six times. The first two times were here, and then the last four times were in California.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I would get stuck in this cycle of like going to treatment, not actually participating in recovery, and then going home and relapsing. And it just was.
I'm sure every time they would tell you not to go home, stay here, do IOP.
Every time.
Give yourself a couple more months, and you'd be like, no, I'm going back home.
Yep. Yep. And I would always get in relationships as well. Relationships were such an issue for me, you know?
Yeah, it's hard because it's like, as someone, like, I've owned drug rehabs for a long time, and it's like, dude, it's like, it's textbook. Like, dude, you could just see the pattern. And, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell who's going to stay clean or whatever, who's going to win the lottery. But there's just some obvious patterns of like, dude, you've been doing this over and over. You're in love with this girl. You're not even trying to stay clean. You think you're just going to go back home. And it's like, it's so obvious to someone looking from the outside. But when it's you, you're just super convinced.
Yep.
That willpower, and you've had enough pain. And you would never go back to using, and you could pass a lie detector test. And dude, people get high on the airplane, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. And the problem is a lot of the girls that I would get with were ones I met in rehab as well. It's like,
of course,
madness.
Mm-hmm. What was rehab like? You know, did you have any periods where you were like, man, I really got a lot out of it? Were you like ever connect with like a therapist a lot? Was there anything that stood out to you that was like starting to plant the seed?
The problem is the first four rehabs that I went to were pretty much scams. Mm. You know, they leaned heavily into luxury, looking nice, amenities, and marketing. That was their two main focuses. It wasn't, oh, let's keep these people sober. Let's get them the right therapist. Let's do things right.
Enable them and get them to come back.
Yeah, 100%. Which you know how, you know, things have been.
Especially during that time. What year was that?
Dude, this was like, I was 21, so this was 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's like the height
of. It was bad.
Yeah. Of like 9 out of 10 drug rehabs were flop, scam, shithole treatment centers.
Yeah. And so the fifth place that I went to, it was actually a good place. Mm-hmm. However, I didn't follow their direction and get a sponsor and work the steps and go to meetings. And I'm not saying that this is wrong. Like it works for some people, but I went to church and I got involved in church recovery meetings and kind of made that like my recovery. But the problem is I didn't have the structure and accountability that you get from having a sponsor, having like a sponsorship family, having a home group, like being involved in AA, which ultimately is what, you know, works for me. Right. Like I stayed sober for 5 months, got a girlfriend, got a job, and decided I was going to move back home with my parents that had had custody of my daughter for the last 3 years, and lost the job. My girlfriend broke up with me, and I'm fighting with my parents because they were resentful because they had my daughter for 3 years, and you know, they were frustrated and whatever. And then somebody showed up. I don't want to expose who it was, but somebody showed up and they're like, I've got a half a gram of heroin. Do you want to get high with me? My dad is a diabetic. He had needles. This is perfect scenario, you know?
Now, when you're in rehab, was your biggest thing like, I have a daughter I got to get back to?
The first like four times. Yeah,
I would imagine. Because a lot of people, dude, it's so hard to convince them to stay and they have a kid. And it's like, dude, you haven't been there for your kid for like the last 5 years. But like now you have 30 days clean. Like another 60 days and outpatient is going to like ruin your relationship with your kid. It's like just, you know, and it's like, man, it's so hard to explain to people. But going home with 30 days clean is totally different than going home with 6 months clean. Like those 4 little months, those 5 extra months, dude, you're a whole nother fucking world.
Yeah.
From 30 days.
100%. Yeah. And like, you know, you've got to, if you stay for 90 days, the chances of you getting all the way through the 12 steps is significantly higher. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to get through that work. Mm-hmm. At least for me, that's what works for me.
No, for sure. Absolutely. And it's like, man, it's so hard to it's like, dude, you've been to rehab 6 times. So that's 6 months of fucking clean time. You just never put it all together. So it's like you just keep stopping early. And it's like if you just had a little more structure for a little bit longer and then maybe did halfway and then like did a little bit of this. And like, because to them, it's they're like, I'm hopeless. This is not working. I've already been to rehab, you know? And it's just like, I always explain to people as I do, when your doctor tells you to leave your cast on for 6 months, you don't take it off after fucking 30 days and then wonder why your arm's all fucked up, you know? So it's like, dude, when you go to treatment, they recommend that you have some type of structure for like 6 months, maybe a year. And after 30 days, you just fucking take the cast off and go back to doing whatever the fuck you're doing.
Yeah. 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 I definitely was not prepared, to say the least, even after the 5 months. And it's because I still wasn't like following directions, you know? Within 3 weeks, I lost 45 pounds. I'd picked my whole entire body, like literally, like from the compulsive picking.
Now, were you always doing this from 21 to 23?
Yeah.
You would use and then just destroy your body and then get it all back and then destroy it again?
Yeah.
And are you posting the memes on Instagram throughout this time?
Not until after this time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because this is what motivated me to get sober is this last relapse. I lost, 45 pounds, picked my whole body. I was so dehydrated. I had maybe like I had maybe drank like 3 bottles of water in 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Like I was like dying, right? And I also slept for like maybe 2 or 3 days out of 3 weeks. I started hanging out with this girl that I had ripped off for $200 worth of Suboxone like 3 years before.
Mm-hmm.
And she hit me up. She's like, hey, can you give me a ride to pick this and that? You know, pick up this and that. So I go pick her up. I give her a ride. And we go back to this hotel room that I had been like living in. And I was knotted out on fentanyl. And I had a bag of meth sitting out. And she put Flocka in the meth that I was doing.
Why?
Because of the $200. That
was like a fuck you?
Yeah. Yeah. Like she had a resentment. And so I sucked it up. I don't even know how much it was. You know, mm-hmm. whenever you're doing it, you just throw it up a pile in there. Sucked it up. And I stuck the needle in my arm. And I pulled it back. The blood went in it. I looked up as I was pushing it down. She was like, I fucking hate you. I fucking hate you. And I did it and blacked out for 3 days. Didn't know who I was. Didn't know where I was. Didn't know how to eat. Couldn't get high. So I was withdrawing. Just complete psychosis. And it was so strong that I would go to sleep and I would wake up still in psychosis. And I slept in between my parents for 3 days. Like at 23 years old, slept in between my parents for 3 days because I was so scared.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is another thing that meth is crazy. So it's like when you shoot heroin, when people have like covered in scabs and with like heroin, it's like, all right, dude, you're a really bad heroin addict. You're stabbing yourself 6 times a day. Yeah. Maybe if you're really bad, dude, you're shooting meth. You're poking yourself like 200 times a day.
Oh, easily.
Easily. Meth, I don't know, but like crack is like the same thing. It doesn't last any long. You got to keep doing it. And it's like with meth, it's like you're just stabbing yourself.
Yeah, and the problem is you get dehydrated really quickly. And whenever you're, this is so graphic, but whenever you're dehydrated, you can't, if you're injecting,
you can't pull back blood.
You can't. It doesn't go into the syringe. So then you're pissed off and frustrated. And if you're withdrawing, oh my God, it is brutal. You'll literally stick yourself like 100 times. Mm. It's awful. Yeah. And I've even done it and was so frustrated. I pulled back on it to the point where the end of the syringe popped off and then all my drugs spilled out and it was all I had and I was withdrawing. I was tripping. That's an awful feeling.
That's crazy. Yeah, it's like, man, my heart goes out to you in that situation.
Yeah.
You're sleeping with your parents.
Yeah.
You're in the psychosis. How do you go from there to getting clean again?
Yeah, so my parents at this point became educated that, you know, a majority of rehabs in the U.S. are scams. So what they did was they...
I just want to clarify, at the time.
At the time. At the time.
Yeah. Now I hear it's pretty cleaned up.
Yeah. I would say it's leaning more toward like 30%.
Yeah.
You know?
I was going to say like 70, 30.
Yeah. 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 And also, look, if you're looking for a rehab, find somebody that is educated enough to help you find the right rehab.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go on Google like down some rabbit hole mm-hmm. looking for whatever, because you know
it's crazy.
There's so much shit on the internet that isn't true, you know. Mm-hmm. So find somebody that can make a appropriate referral, you know, or ask questions. Ask as many questions as you can.
Yeah, because it's like, dude, you're staying there for 30 days. You want to read reviews, you want to talk to people.
100%.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And, so my parents found a place in California in Palm Springs, that essentially I could stay at for 90 days in a sober living that was going to require me to have structure and routine and work the 12 steps. So I went to a place, got detoxed, got stabilized, and then went into a sober living and stayed there. But in between that period of time, I came out of psychosis And I was withdrawing bad. I mean, I hadn't been able to get high for 3 days. I was like in the middle of full-blown withdrawals, like came straight out of psychosis to that. And it was not a great experience.
Are you withdrawing from opiates and meth?
Yeah, because of fentanyl. I was injecting fentanyl. yeah, so I came out of it and my parents essentially drove me to the hood to get what I needed because I wasn't going to make it if not. But they literally had a flight booked and the rehab already waiting, and I'd already done the assessment while I was like tripping. I have no idea how I did it. Mm-hmm. So it was ready to go when I came out of psychosis. So my parents drove me to the hood and drove me 2 hours to Columbus, Ohio to the airport. And the whole way there, I'm like getting high in their back seat. My dad's got like Narcan, like waiting in case I overdose. And
this is the first time you used in front of them?
No, tons of times before that. Because I just didn't care. And I think that their mindset was,
oh, at least we could watch them.
At least we could watch them, and we got Narcan and we could call 911. Because my mom was an MRI tech at a hospital. So mm-hmm. she was always on call. And that was her biggest fear in the middle of the night, getting that work call, thinking, oh, is this the sheriff's office like mm-hmm. calling to tell me that they found him or whatever. I remember my dad turned around and looked at me and he said, do you want to be buried or do you want to be cremated? Because if you don't stop, that's the only two choices that you have left.
Wow.
And it hit me, you know, it hit me hard. I was like, I knew that I was going to die. And if I wasn't going to die, I was going to suffer until I did. Because I had done enough experimenting to know. And I took it serious. I went to treatment and I took it serious.
So, you know, I had a guy on the show and he was like, when I went to rehab, I studied everything as if I was going to take a test at the end of that for $1 million. And he was like, I sat up front, I took notes. And like, some people don't like they think they're taking it serious, but you're just like, bro, you're not.
Yeah.
Like you're fucking passing notes to girls, you know, you're fucking stealing Pop-Tarts, like you're fucking off in group, you're fucking in the bathroom for fucking 45 minutes. And all those little things kind of like add up. It's like when the rubber hits the road, the only thing that's going to be able to tell is how serious and how much work you did. So
yeah,
what was it like, you know, really paying attention in treatment and really like making an effort?
Yeah, I think for me, because I had literally just been through like legit 5 months of treatment. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like a refresher, you know, it was a lot of the similar stuff. Mm-hmm. But what was different was the 12 steps for me at that point. And I lived in an all male sober living.
Fire.
Oh yeah. It was great. And it was in an old hotel that they converted to apartments. Mm-hmm. So there was four of us in our own apartment. Mm-hmm. And every day you're up at 6 o'clock. We have a 12 step meeting every single morning. Literally, we'd have to make our bed clean. Like, you know, there was actual routine to it. We weren't being like fluffed by some mm-hmm. like nice place that just wanted to keep us there, you know? Yeah. It was like somewhere where you actually had to put some work in.
Yeah, I've owned a drug rehab for like 7 years. And one of my biggest things is like, dude, I would fucking die before I make co-ed living.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, and other people in the rehab business was like, oh, we do co-ed, we do it the right way or whatever. And it's like, dude, the men should not be sleeping in the same place as the women. And it's like, it's just like distraction. And then like when the guys have a problem, they want to show off to the girls. And then the girls don't want to go to the pool because they have like body dysmorphia issues. And then it's like this fucking popularity contest. And it's just like, dude, when like, you know, when you separate like the genders and housing, it's just a whole nother vibe, and it's really what people need. And then it's like you're competing against the rehab across the street who's like, hey, come to my rehab and bring your girlfriend. You could sleep together, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like fucking, man, it's interesting that is like a new thing, you know? Oh, man, I went to an all-male halfway. It's like, good, dude.
Yeah.
You know, it's sad that like that needs to be clarified, but it's like, bro, why the fuck would a halfway be co-ed?
Yeah, the first one I went to here, it was like, it was in Palm Beach Gardens, and it was an apartment complex, And like the back half of it was like the women's house. Like they literally lived on the mm-hmm. other side of the fence. It's like, you know, and there would be like two techs there for like 50 people. It's like wild.
Yeah. And when you're like a drug addict, you're like, what's the big deal? You know, but it's like, dude, those little things really make a difference in someone's recovery.
Definitely.
And it's life or death at that point. When you got out of treatment, what was some of the first things you did?
I went and moved to Huntington Beach with it sounds crazy because I had issues with relationships, mm-hmm. but with two girls that I've been friends with that were also in recovery, but they were like two of my like really, really good friends. Mm-hmm. So I went and stayed with them in Huntington Beach, got involved in meetings, stayed in meetings. And then my childhood best friend, she didn't have any kind of insurance or anything. She passed away now from fentanyl. Mm. But she was really struggling. So like she flew out and moved in and like detoxed on our couch and just like stayed sober there for like a year. So I was just kind of like with her every day. I wasn't worried about like work or hustling, making mm-hmm. money or any of that. I went to the gym every day, went to meetings every day, and my family supported me through it, you know? Mm-hmm. They pretty much were like, hey, look, you know, they didn't have a lot, but everything extra they did have, they put into me being able to focus on my recovery.
Hell yeah. When did you start posting like the before and afters?
I was like literally 2 weeks sober. Mm-hmm. I could barely even talk. I literally, the Flocka like damaged my body to the point where I literally talked like this for like a month. Mm-hmm. So before I could even talk right, I was like posting on mm-hmm. Facebook.
And then like what kind of comedy were you doing?
So like if you went on iFunny, you could find it right mm-hmm. now. But one of the things I made, it was like it was my picture mm-hmm. and it said felt cute, might steal the copper out of your AC later. Mm. And that like went stupid viral.
Wow.
And oh man, there was this one. It's so bad. And it goes around every Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And it pisses me off because I've matured so much since this, right? And it said, I made a fake news article. And it said, man gets caught having sex with a frozen turkey behind a dumpster.
And it's your face.
And it's my face. And every time it goes viral, I've got all these people that follow me, like, commenting, like, oh, these people made this meme of you. Mm. Like, they're so bad. Like, you know, this and that. And it's like, I'm the one that made it, you know?
At least you made it. Does it bother you now seeing some of that stuff? Or does it just, like, does it annoy you sometimes?
Like the memes?
Well, just like, you know, your before and after, like
it's, I've used it so much.
It's the, probably the most popular before and after I've ever seen.
Yeah. You know what it is? I've used it so much to help so many people mm-hmm. that I'm desensitized to seeing it. Like, mm-hmm. and it's a good reminder that, you know, that's how I end up if I use.
Yeah.
So I look at it every day.
It's cool because a lot of people don't have anything like that. Like I have one picture when I got arrested, but like that was really before like it got really bad. But like I don't have any videos or pictures of like, you know, my worst days using.
Have you seen the videos as well?
Yeah. Yeah. Your videos are crazy.
Yeah.
The fact that you have a video and picture is just like, is wild because people wouldn't believe it.
Oh, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. Like, I wouldn't have believed
people
it.
People probably say all the time, like, oh, you look so normal. Or like, I can't imagine you being like that.
You know, I honestly wouldn't have believed it. If my mm-hmm. parents didn't take those videos and pictures, I would have never believed that I was like that. Because I wouldn't have remembered it. Because mm-hmm. I was so high.
What? When did you start taking the social media a little more seriously?
I was... I got a job doing marketing and business development mm-hmm. and admissions at about a year sober. And a lot of that was based on like the awareness I could generate through social media. Mm-hmm. But even then, like I remember like I would post and maybe get like 50 likes on a post. Mm-hmm. And if I got lucky every few months, I would get a post that would go viral and it would get like 10,000 shares and like 1,000 likes or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I, even though it was discouraging to only post something and get like 50 likes, you know, I stuck with it. I was serious for, you know, from the beginning, because the way that I saw it was, even if I could help one person, even if I could inspire, you know, a family member to reach out or whatever, like anything, then it was worth what I was putting into it. But I would say I really started to see results about 2.5-3 years in. And then TikTok came out. Well, it had already been out, but TikTok started getting really big. And I started making these videos. They were awful. So cringeworthy. And I would go viral like straight away, like getting like 1 million views, 2 million views, 3 million views. And I realized like, oh, like I could actually build something on TikTok. Then Facebook came out with Reels.
Yeah.
And they started to monetize Reels as well.
You used to be able to make a lot of money.
Oh, dude, I made crazy money off of Facebook just from posting. And yeah, so I, that's when I really like started taking it serious, because I was like, okay, this is a career.
Career now.
You know? Yeah, and I exploded overnight. Like literally, like now I've got like 1.3 million followers, almost 1.4.
On which platform?
Between all of them.
Wow.
But my Instagram like grows constantly. Like last month I made a post of my wife's before and after of her recovery, because she has a lot of videos as well. And it got, you know, to this day it's got 46 million views.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Dude, it's wow. Wild. 46 million is crazy. Wow. Yeah. Wow. How did you meet your wife?
Through a Facebook recovery group.
Really?
And I'm not giving anybody advice. Like, I don't think you should be going on there looking for anything.
She's like, your before and afters are cool. Mine are cool too.
Well, so she's British. And
So she's never lived here.
No. Well, yeah, we were here for a year and a half after we met. But what happened was she posted in like a recovery group. That she, you know, had X, Y, and Z amount of time sober. This was like a year before COVID. And I added her because I'm like, oh, she's cute and she's British, you know, whatever. And we started talking a little bit over a year period. And then COVID happened and we were both isolated and lonely. And yeah, she started FaceTiming me and we just were talking. And I decided I was going to get my passport. It took 4 months to get my passport because of COVID. So we got to know each other over that period of time. And then I flew over and we met. And that's how it happened.
So you guys have been talking for a year?
On and off for a year. And then...
Seriously, for 4 months?
Yeah.
What was it like meeting her?
Dude, it was awesome.
Were you like, I'm in love, I'm getting married?
Yeah, yeah. I proposed quick.
Dude. Shut up.
Swear.
How quick?
Like a month
in person.
Yeah. That's the addict in me.
Yeah.
But it's been honestly the best thing. She also got pregnant quick as well. And we have a son.
Wow.
And he's awesome. Dude, he's awesome.
How old is he now?
He's 2.5.
Wow.
Yeah.
When you flew over there, what was it like being in the UK?
Weird.
Weird.
So weird.
Because when you told me you live in the UK, I was like, that's weird. I just assumed you were in from America, but you live in the UK now.
Yeah, well.
How different is it than the US?
I'm in the process of living there, but it's such a long process, like any kind of, you know, immigration. I mean, it's still westernized. So even though culturally they are different, they talk different, but they're like quite similar in lots of ways, you know? But it was like a massive culture shock. People over there communicate in a way different way.
How?
They almost, they can seem quite depressing and rude almost, but they're just kind of minding their own business. That's what it is. Everybody minds their own business over there. But if you talk to people, they're so friendly. They're awesome. But if you were to meet somebody like in the street and you didn't have much communication, you'd be like, oh, that person's quite rude, you know? So it was, and where I'm from, and very much like in Florida, everybody is like overly kind. It's like the Southern hospitality almost, you know?
Depends who you ask. There's some people that are like, fuck Florida, they fucking so rude or whatever.
That's because a bunch of New Yorkers lived on there.
Exactly. And it's like, I've met New Yorkers who are like, what the fuck is, you know, it's just, I don't know. I think I've definitely had experiences with people being like overly friendly. And I've also had people being like super short, but yeah, I mean, in Japan, it's kind of like, I went to Japan a couple months ago and it's like, dude, people aren't really trying to talk much, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. In the last year, I've been to like 13 countries.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's your favorite?
South Africa.
Really?
Dude, I love it there.
What? What is there? I want to go there. I was planning a trip in like June, but I don't know if I'm going to go. Dude,
it is the best place. Why? Honestly. So don't get me wrong, it's dangerous. I will say that. I'll get that over with. You have to be cautious. You have to know people. If you go there, I'll hook you up with like drivers and stuff. But dude, the recovery there is incredible. Really? It is so solid. They're awesome. The treatment facilities there are amazing.
Oh, yeah.
The food there, incredible. Our money is worth like significantly more than theirs. So, dude, you can live like a king there for like a fraction of what it is here.
Yeah, I was thinking about moving because I'm like, because I used to always tell people like, dude, if you could do your job remote.
Dude, South Africa, 1,000%.
Really?
You could have a 7-bedroom mansion there. Like, not even exaggerating. 7-bedroom mansion, like, in a gated community, like, an armed driver, maids, like, everything for, like, you could buy a 7-bedroom mansion there for, like, $200,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And, wow. And be in the middle of, like, 5 safari parks. Like an hour drive to safari parks and eat the highest quality food for like I love steak, right? You could get the best steak you've ever had there for like $20. Like, and that's like the best steak you've ever had.
Wow.
And I love the people. They're incredible.
That's awesome. Can you explain like what you do now? Cause you're telling me like you work for a lot of international treatment centers and stuff like that now.
Yeah. So I have a case management company that's international. We work with families around the world. And what that looks like is we do case management, outside case management. We do interventions, sober companionship, and sober transport. So I've, you know, worked with families literally all over the world to provide those services. But then also I create podcasts for treatment facilities to raise awareness for their programs. And I provide like digital marketing consulting. So I help them set up different campaigns and raise awareness or change things about their marketing, just to get the word out, really.
Awesome. How long have you been clean now?
On February 21st, it was 6 years.
Hell yeah. That's so cool. What's your relationship like with your parents?
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I mean, they're just super proud of the work I put in and I'm grateful for them and they still have my custody of my daughter, but you know, I'm at a point in my life now where she goes to England with me whenever I go, you know, and can be there for, you know, the whole summer or whenever. And, yeah, we just have a great relationship.
That's awesome. If you could say anything to anyone who's struggling or has family that's struggling, what's like some of the first things you tell people?
Yeah, I would say, no matter what you do, whether you decide to go to rehab or not, no matter what, and I don't care whether it's AA, NA, CA, you know, smart recovery, like I literally don't care what mode of recovery you decide to go with, get connected to a community of like-minded people that understands you, that can support you and guide you in the right direction. And don't ever think that you can do it on your own. First off, you shouldn't have to do it on your own. But I have spoke to literally thousands of people that suffer from addiction from every part of the world. I've worked in rehabs in every part of the world, you know, and every single person is the same. I haven't seen too many people that have isolated and kept it a secret and not connected with people that have got better.
Mm-hmm.
So tell everybody you can that you're suffering, that you need help, get connected to a community, and yeah, reach out. Honestly, that's the best thing you can do is reach out.
Thank you, man. Let everyone know where they can find you at, like what your social medias are.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can find me if you type in Hunter Michael Shepherd, on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, or Hunter Versus Addiction is my other platforms as well.
Hell yeah. Hey, thanks for coming on the show, man. I appreciate you.
Dude, it's been great. Thank you.